Main character of the book is a young lady who is of shipbuilding family, but she's the only survivor. Okay, the rest have been killed by pirates, so she's out for revenge, right? So she's built these new ships, or they're being built, and she's on her way back from a large city where she's hired several officers, okay? But the problem with her is she gets ruinously seasick. So one of the captains has a little herbal skill and gives her a little bit of scopolamine. So she's looped, all right? So she wakes up in her room, in her cabin. Koiber, Cynthia rolled over, struggling against her bedclothes. Lights streamed through the port, but she had no idea of the time of day or even how many days they'd been at sea. She looked around the little cabin, squinting into the shadows, but Koiber wasn't there. Troilin? No one materialized from the gloom. She was alone. That was good. She had to use the chamber pot and didn't want to offend anybody. She rolled out of the bunk, wobbled slightly with the roll of the ship. She hoisted her nightgown and saw to necessities. Then stood and remembered that she was supposed to do something when she woke up. She was awake. A quick pinch confirmed this. They told her to call them when she woke because she was supposed to do something, but she couldn't remember what. Maybe the captain knows, she said, staring at the door to the cabin. Captains know everything. Swagger captains. There were two latches to the door. She grabbed the one that wasn't looking at her and turned it. She knew the other one wanted to bite her and felt the rush of satisfaction that she'd outsmarted it. Maybe next time, she told the false latch, stepping through the closing door behind. Now, where's my 7 lucky steps? She found the companionway up to the main cabin with little difficulty and ascended the steps with a remarkable ease. Only one latch on this door, and it didn't look like it would bite, so she turned it and stepped onto the deck. Mistress Flaxel? A crewman stood before her. She recognized him, but couldn't recall his name. He didn't look like he would bite her either, but the snake coming out of his right ear might, so she mumbled a greeting and turned away to climb to the quarterdeck. She heard a crewman call out her name, then he called out some other names. Names she knew, although she couldn't really remember who they belonged to. She needed to find the captain and find out what she was supposed to do. Another crewman met up with her on the quarterdeck, and she remembered his name. She'd hired him in Sing, and he didn't have any snakes coming out of his ears. Mr. Flaxel, are you all right? I'm looking for the captain, Mr. Korak. She looked past him to the helmsman and was wondering how he could manage to steer the ship when all the spokes of the wheel had turned into pickles. They had to be slippery. She looked back to Korak. I need to speak to Captain Ubin. Captain's off watch, miss. Master Smythe, the mate's on watch. But he's below. There's something I have to do. I have to ask the captain. Something I have to do. Yes, mistress, you're supposed to eat a meal when you wake and call for Captain Troilin. He looked at her nervously. I don't think you were supposed to come up on deck. Leastways, not wearing nothing but your nightdress, miss. I wasn't? She looked down and realized that she was indeed wearing nothing but a nightgown. I like the fresh air, Master Korak. Please bring a robe from my cabin and have the cook prepare a meal for me. Aye, mistress. He looked at her worriedly again, but as she turned, someone else approached. A dark-skinned woman with a curious little winged man on her shoulder. That seemed very strange. She wondered if it was a hallucination. Troilin had said that tea could make her have waking dreams. Mistress, are you all right? The woman asked. Yes, I'm fine, but I forgot my robe. I wanted to find the captain, but he's off watch, so Mr. Korak is going to get my robe. Then the little winged man fluttered from the woman's shoulder and landed on her own, chattering high-pitched nonsense in her ear. She started, but then suddenly remembered this was Mouse. And the dark-skinned woman was Volta. She looked around the quarterdeck, shaking her head. Sorry, I'm a little confused. I think it's the tea. I think so too, mistress. Let's just go back down to the cabin, okay? I like the fresh air, she said, stepping to the rail. Volta was instantly beside her, one hand on her shoulder. But Cynthia's steps were sure and steady. She liked the motion of the ship. The easy roll with the big swell, as the big swells lifted the bow and let her rise over them. Can I have my lunch up here? I don't see why not, really. The weather's fine. We could set up a table. Cynthia looked down... Cynthia looked down into the depths, past the dancing shafts of sunlight, into the blue, into the undulating colors, into the heart of the sea. There were shapes down there, shapes moving in the darkness. They had long, graceful tails and webbed hands. She remembered them from her other dreams, the fluid motions of their caressing touch. Can I sail with them? With whom, mistress? Volta looked down at the water, squinting and shading her eyes. There's nothing down there, just water. They're down there. They're always down there. Their hands are so soft. I'd really like to... I don't think it's a good idea, mistress. We're well offshore, and the nearest land is the Shattered Isles there, so it wouldn't be a good place for a swim. The Shattered Isles? Cynthia's gaze rose from the mesmerizing depths to the distant row of islands abeam the ship. She could see four of them clearly, towering in green, each with a cap of clouds, and one sporting a plume of smoke at its center. These must be the southern ones. They're nothing like the northern ones. All flat and sandy. She squinted, trying to remember the charts. Aye, mistress. Those are Minos, Ataros, and Plume. We've a half a dozen more before we can pass and make our tack. Of course. It all made sense, coming from Volta's mouth, but she couldn't dredge up the details on her own, from her own mind. The confusion frustrated her, but she couldn't seem to make herself care a great deal. Is lunch ready? I'm hungry. It'll be a bit yet, mistress. But Carrick's here with your robe, so you should be more comfortable. They draped the robe over her shoulders, and several more men appeared from below decks. The one she didn't recognize immediately, but he just gave her a curious glance before going to the helmsman and giving orders to steer the ship. He didn't mention the pickles. The other two, she knew. Good to see you on your feet, mistress. Cynthia, how do you feel? Good. A little confused, but good. Thank you, Troilon. Are you going to make me some more tea? Yes, but not quite as strong as the last, I think. The tall fellow bowed to her and turned to go. She decided not to tell him that his ears were on fire. As if he didn't know, he'd find out soon enough. Hi, Feldrin, how are you? Very good, mistress. The huge man grinned at her, moving to the rail beside her. All of your cuts healed up? I hate you to start leaking blood. Not yet healed, but better, thank you. Well, I won't be leaking any blood, I promise. Don't make promises you can't keep, Feldrin. Hey, what's that island smoking? Is it on fire? That's Plume Island, mistress. It's one of the islands that has an active volcano. Nobody goes there. Oh, right. Camels. Camels? The southern islands all have camels. Nobody wants to go there and be eaten. Oh, yeah. You mean cannibals. That's right. We leave them a wide berth. Cannibals, right. And we go on. But she's right looped. And later on we have a passage where the Captain Bloodwind, who is the primary villain in the story, is sitting down to breakfast with his slave, who has become his willing slave after some 10 years. She's finally given up and given in to his advances. And they are interrupted by his evil sorceress, Hydra. The storm grows, my captain, Hydra said, entering the room without preamble. She wore a familiar guise of a sensuous young woman, but Camilla ignored it, knowing what lurked beneath. She kept her eyes on her plate, concentrating on her breakfast. She'd eaten well since her transformation from slavery. The cost seemed trifling when compared to the years of hunger and degradation. I don't need a sorceress to tell me that, Bloodwind said, around a mouthful of kippered flying fish. I can hear the wind through the shutters and see it bending the palms. What I can't see is Hippotron. It's one of the ships. Tell me if my new ship is in peril. The storm will pass through the fathomless reaches tonight. The winds will bear southeasterly, shifting south and then southwest as it passes. She shrugged, strolling slowly around the table while tracing one long, slender finger along the back of Camilla's chair. Hippotron sails west of Carbuncle Shoal, holding a southerly course. Yodern does not know the force of this storm, nor its tack. His speed is diminished, but even beating against the wind, he's making 10 knots. So he's sailing right into it. Bloodwind considered the delicate fish arrayed on his plate. Put his fork down and shifted his gaze to Hydra's pitiless eyes. Can you protect them, shift the storm, or divert some of the winds? Such a storm is beyond my power, my captain. I can calm the seas around the ship, but doing so will require a great amount of energy, and I will need... Her fingertips brushed Camila's bare shoulder. Sustenance. Camila pulled away, shuddering with the chill caress. Both women jumped as Bloodwind buried the point of a dagger under the tabletop. The violence of his thrust upset a pot of preserves, and sticky sweet stain as red as blood spread slowly across the white linen. Bloodwind's voice, low and smooth as the freshly pressed tablecloth, bore an edge as sharp as the dagger in his hand. I told you once, Hydra, touch her again and we'll put this in your eye. Of the two of you, I value her company more than yours. Ah, but Captain, she said easily, slithering around the table in a character of feminine seduction, she brings you only pleasure of the flesh, while I bring you gold. And at what price? The sorceress wrapped one slim hand around the blade of the dagger embedded in the table and slid her palm up the edge. Camila cringed at the black ichor oozing from between her fingers and the hiss of the smoke on the table. Only a little blood. You'll have your price, Hydra, but not her. The pirate stood and wrenched the dagger from the table, black liquid smoldering upon the blade, pitting the fine steel. He cast it aside and fixed her with an equally smoldering glare. I will send you as many slaves as you require. Protect Hypotrin. I will try, my captain. She inspected the cut on the palm and smiled. Her sensuous curves swayed like the undulations of a serpent as she left the room. She's dangerous, Camila said, pushing away her plate, her appetite destroyed. She will kill us all if she doesn't get what she wants. Rest easy, my dear, Bloodwind rounded the table and took her hand, escorting her from the breakfast area to the shuttered doors that led out into the balcony. The doors shook with the rising storm. There's no shortage of slaves for her to devour. Unfortunately, her services are indispensable for my plan, and she knows it. And your plan? Your real plan? She knew now that he coveted more than gold, that power was his true seduction. But how much power? My plan, dear Camila, he said as he reached the latch, is to have everything. He turned the latch and flung the shutter aside. Storm winds and tepid rain drenched them both to the skin in an instant as he pushed her onto the balcony. He encircled her with one strong arm, drawing her close, as he swept his other in an arc to indicate the entirety of Blood Bay. Wind and rain thrashed through the palms and mangroves, the power of the storm gripping Camila, even as she shivered with the drenching rain. Its strength and violence reminded her of Bloodwind, as if he were a personification of nature's most horrific force. I want it all, Camila. This is just the beginning. I want everything. He pulled her close, his palm cupping her cheek and bringing her face to his, and you will have everything with me. She moved with him as he guided her into the lee of one of the massive pillars that supported the stone over their heads, the rock pressing against her back, rough through the silk of her gown, in contrast to the softness of his lips as they pressed against hers. Slowly, gently, he drew down the shoulders of her dress. This was the cost of her freedom from torment. No small price, but she relinquished it, drawing him to her as his hands rent the fabric of her sodden gown. Everything, he said in her ear, his hushed voice barely audible above the driving rain and the roaring in her ears as he and the storm surged against her bared flesh. Yes, she whispered back. Everything. That is Scimitar Move. And I bit off more of a bit than I had planned, but...
Okay. There's two options. I can either read a somewhat larger section from my first novel, which was published last year, The Third Sign, or I can read the opening to this and the opening to my novel currently on submission that my agent is shopping to publishers now. So I don't know if people have... They're two very different kinds of fantasies. So a little more of this or some of this and some of the other. Since we have a few people...
It's a democracy.
Oh my God,
we're going to hear all that.
No one has any preference at all? All right, I'll do prologue and prologue then, because why not? This is an epic fantasy, as you will hear. I don't usually write epic fantasy. It's weird that it happened to be the novel that first got published. The other one is a very different kind of fantasy. But in any case, I hope it speaks for itself. Torek Ilmon, the most recent member of a farmer's bloodline stretching back centuries, perhaps even before the dreamer's first dream, wiped beads of sweat from his brow before bending again to drive his hoe into the earth. It was late summer, and already hints of the oncoming fall were in the air, but hot work was hot, regardless of the season. The harvest had been particularly good this year, as good as any that even Torek's grandfather could remember, but that did little to alleviate his workload. Reaping the fruitfulness of the earth had left many wounds, and the soil had to be worked, turned, coaxed back to its natural aerated condition if it was to yield similar results next spring. This was tiring, tedious work for most, but for Torek it represented a kind of spiritual ritual, a bonding with the land he needed to experience each year to feel he was fulfilling the promise of his heritage. Land was meant to be tilled, dug, shoveled, filtered. It was meant to be used and cared for so that it could be used again, and Torek felt the weight of that responsibility keenly. All the Ilmones did. He was perhaps not the most creative thinker or possessed of the most ambitious, quick mind, but he was committed to his work and difficult to sway from a path he had set for himself. Pulling back on the hoe handle again, Torek stood the implement in the earth as he straightened, sighing with the effort. He looked over his field, almost all resurfaced now from his work with the hoe, and beyond it to the borders of the wood that lay to the east of the Ilmone farm. Tragsclaw Wood was the official name of the forest, but despite the rumors, it seldom produced anything more dramatic than a wandering bear. Unnatural creatures were few, unexpected events even fewer. Torek liked it that way, as did his neighbors. Their lives were founded on regular, predictable cycles, and their existence depended upon careful planning and the application of age-old wisdom. Successions, disasters, wars certainly happened beyond the borders of his homeland, informally known as the Fields by its residents, but such occurrences made little impact upon its inhabitants. They were content to live as they had for centuries, and it had indeed been centuries since anyone had bothered to interfere with that simple life. Torek grunted with satisfaction as he leaned on his hoe, looking around the borders of his land. Far to the south lay the hills which ran between Tragsclaw Wood to the east and the southernmost area of Razorwood to the west, and even farther to the north were the major cities of the nation of Clun. But Torek, as ever, was most interested in his own space. In his grandfather's time, the field had barely extended to 10 acres, but now it was nearly double that, one of the largest farms in the area and expanding every year. He employed a group of laborers to help him with the upkeep, of course, but they had already been sent home. Torek wanted time to work the land alone, and the unusually good harvest had given him the luxury to indulge himself. This was the time he loved, a few hours of silent thought and careful tending of his ancestral ground. Torek smiled and shook himself out of his late afternoon reverie. He didn't want to waste the remaining light. Bending again to his work, he drove his hoe into the earth. And then, quite suddenly, the air changed. A stillness fell across the land. The wind sank to a sigh, and the atmosphere seemed to close around Torek, who looked up with a frown. The weathermaster in the next village told him there was not likely to be rain for at least another week, but all weathermasters were notoriously inaccurate in their predictions. And even when they were right, and the one Torek had consulted was known for his precision, other weathermasters could generate rain at inopportune times when paid enough by jealous rival farmers. Still, such an occurrence had not happened for several years, and he could think of no reason for a weather call to be made now. He sniffed the air and caught a faint, acrid scent. After a pause, he returned to his work, hoping to at least finish the field he was working on before the rain arrived. But only a few seconds passed before a low moan echoed across the fields. Torek looked up sharply. The sound was fairly loud without any prior warning to have heralded it and seemed relatively close by. Perhaps a bear had stepped on the wrong end of a stick, Torek reasoned, but just as he was about to accept the logical answer and focus his attention back on the earth, the moaning came again, more loudly this time and closer. It seemed to come from Tragsclaw Wood, and Torek squinted in that direction. He saw nothing but the fences at the end of his land and the trees beyond. But the stillness seemed to grow more oppressive with every passing minute, and there were no clouds visible in the afternoon sky. The moaning sounded again, louder and with a different timbre. Torek thought he heard some kind of a yowling or screeching, like a cat whose late-night caterwauls were silenced by a thrown rock or rival feline. Inadvertently, he shivered. This was no storm, and there was no animal he knew that made such an unearthly sound. Dropping his hoe, he ran to his nearby cart and pulled out a scythe. It was hardly a weapon of war, but its blade was sharp, and he had killed a wolf with it one winter several years ago. But that wolf had been young, and Torek had not been alone then. He had no idea what he was facing this time. In truth, he had little wish to investigate the noise himself, but he was alone and had no time to run for others. And despite all his imaginings, the sound likely had a simple explanation. Sounds always did. Why give his neighbors the idea that he was imagining things? Gripping the scythe firmly, he ran towards the forest. Torek was no coward, but as he approached the edge of Tragsclaw, his steps slowed. Tragsclaw was not the darkest of woods, nor the densest, but today it felt different. Ominous, imposing, heavy. With every step he took, the air seemed to grow closer and more difficult to breathe. After a while, he felt as if he were slogging through mud, so syrupy had the atmosphere become. Pausing at the forest's edge, the sides handle damp from his sweat, he peered cautiously into the greenery. He saw nothing but the trees standing silent guard on the forest border, scrubs and moss at their feet. But beyond its unnatural stillness, something struck him as wrong about the forest, though he could not put his finger on what it was. His nose and throat stung with the acrid tang of the air. He was so focused upon the unnatural atmosphere that he had entirely forgotten about what had drawn him to the forest in the first place, the sound. Suddenly the moan echoed again, but this time it seemed to be nearly on top of him, and far louder. And now he clearly heard that it was more than a moan. It sounded like several creatures screaming or yelping at once, but, and this he could not understand, they seemed to be both opposed and combined in some way, like some kind of bizarre chorus of discontent. He froze and looked around slowly. Nothing stirred. And he suddenly realized what had eluded his notice before. He saw no living movement at all. No birds flew, no squirrels stirred, no fox darted from tree to tree. He bent down to the ground and dug experimentally. No insects could be seen in the earth, neither worm nor beetle. The land around him seemed utterly, entirely devoid of life. Torek shook his head and turned away from the woods. Strange as it might seem to his neighbors, something was clearly wrong, and he would rather be labeled a coward than a fool. He headed back to his cart, but he felt as if he were walking through sand. It was now very difficult to breathe fully, and the air felt as if it were trying to crush his body into the earth. His mind swam. His eyes darted from side to side. He had the odd feeling he was waiting for something. All at once, a great moaning and screeching arose, seemingly all around him, the most terrible noise Torek had ever heard. Screaming and howling came up from the forest, but not as isolated noises. Rather, they made up a noise together, one sound of painful torment. As Torek dropped to his knees in terror, he heard, for several seconds, what he swore were voices, human voices, shrieking in the most wrenching agony he could have imagined. He struggled to rise, but all energy and strength had deserted him, and his brain was unable to command his legs to move again. His breath came in labored gasps. As he turned his head to look back at the woods, he caught a glimpse of swirling colors and odd shapes, and then, with one more deafening scream of agony, it burst out of the forest and was upon him. The soul wall ravaged north, and there had never been any sound more horrible than that of its passing, now joined by one more unreasoning, hideously distorted shout of agony, as if ripped from the lungs of a still-living man. So that's that. And, as I said, epic fantasy. And, okay. And then this one. As I said, very, very different. This is from the novel Icarus, which is currently on submission. On the day that Icky fell into the volcano, making one hell of a racket when he landed, I didn't know then he always made entrances like that. That was the first I laid eyes on the kid. I was out digging for flame petals with Rig. Like usual, Rig was bellyaching about having to do work, and like usual, I was telling him to shove it. How are we going to make it if we don't have something to sell, I says, and he gives me those big eyes of his and droops his ears down like always when I yell at him. No, I'm not going to hear it, you, I says. You don't do all that much work, you know. What if I treated you like other people treat their solars, And he pretends not to hear me, you know, snuffing around, scratching his ear, waving those two tails like he's got an itch he can't scratch. I could, you know, I says. I could keep you caged up for as long as I want and no one would give a hoot. There's lots of things solars ought to be treated like pests, you know, like flicker brads or something. And of course he looks up at me and starts howling, you know, so sensitive, that friggin' thing, which is pretty funny for something that stands about as tall as I do, which ain't very tall, but still. Yeah, never mind that, I says. I'll just think about it, you know. Maybe nice cage, some magister ice around it or something. And then Rig just loses it, you know, just starts a-crying and howling and carrying on, and I starts thinking about him waking some flame demon or something, and then wouldn't we be set? All right, I says finally. Quit the funeral, I won't cage you. But you gotta do your work, or I won't be able to afford to even buy a cage, or keep the house. You gotta do the work. And he jumps up and starts running around, you know, trying to jump on me and practically knocking me into the lava flow. Yeah, enough, I says. Let's just get to it. And off he goes, like a flicker brad, flying away from a cool, bounding ahead of me and sniffing like he's got something stuck up his nose. Rig's a pain sometimes, but I gotta say there ain't no better solar west of the hole, not when it comes to finding flame petals. They grow below the ground where the flow still moves a bit, and it's way too hot for most of us grounders to look. For a solar, well, you could throw them in fresh lava and they'd barely feel it. But a lot of them can't really smell worth a damn, and a lot of the rest are too wild to use. That's why folks tend to stay away from them. You catch one side of those tails flying, red fur bristling, and of course those teeth and those crazy sideways eyes, and most just head the other way. I can't say as I blame them, really. Rig's wild too, I guess, but only because he don't want to listen sometimes. Ah, but he's not dangerous, or leastways not to me. He's a big baby, to tell you the truth. But he can smell all right. I've seen him sniff out a pellar from half a mile away when most solars would have been running in circles, even though we tried to eat it when he found it, like usual. I told him 100 times, don't eat those things. They don't show their spikes till after they're swallowed. But he won't listen, and then I got to hear him howling for 3 Santa cycles till he finishes digesting. Not the biggest brains in the ball, for sure. But still, he can find those flame petals when he's got a mind to. On his best solar cycle, I've seen him find 10, and that'll go a ways down here. But for a while, we've been coming up pretty light. 2, 3, maybe 4 on a good dig. And I was starting to get worried. I got bills to pay, you know? Rig took us over the West Plains a good way, sniffing and scratching the ground, and a couple times I thought we had something. He'd stop, smell, dig a bit. But each time he only got down a bit into the dirt and then was off again after the next set. No worries. Even in the best digs, you can get a couple of false starts. But nearly a full Santa cycle went by and nothing. Not even a broken flame petal, something I could maybe have tried to plant and get something out of. Finally, Rig sat down panting, and I didn't blame him. I was tired as a magman myself, and I couldn't have gone much further. So I plopped myself down on a rock and waited, taking a swig from the canteen now and again as I looked about, while Rig rolled around and basically made a fool of himself. We'd come a lot farther than even I thought before, almost nearing the Central Plains, and this wasn't territory I knew too well, except to be careful of it. You hear stories, you know, tales of folks vanishing without a trace. Crazy tales for crazy people, I always say, but still, you don't live long down here without knowing how to keep your eyes open and your ears near the ground much as you can. Mountains rose up to the north, up where some say the Firbargs live, if you still think they're alive like some fool people do, but no offense meant if you're one of them. And to the south, the lava pools of the Salamander Kings. To the east, I could make out the stretch of rock that covers the Central Plains, and far in the distance, farther than I could see, was the East Plains, as farther than I've ever been, too. And beyond them was the hole, leastways if I remember what my dad told me when I was just old enough to be foolish. Don't go that far, son, he used to say. Don't go any farther than you need to go to get by. You stay in the places you know and you'll never be caught napping. And I never was. Well, leastways not until I met Icky. Nah, I stayed in the West where folks are, well, they ain't decent exactly, but at least you know the kind of damn folks they are anyways. Of course, if it had been up to my dad, I wouldn't have been doing what I was doing to begin with. He was a prospector and taught me most everything I knew, but he hated every cycle of it. What he really loved doing was crafting. He cranked out gadgets and gizmos like they was going out of style, which it turned out they already had by the time he made them. But nothing got my pop down. Made some fire crystal goggles no one wanted, melted them down, turned them into windows to keep the heat down inside. No one wanted those either. Broke them into bits, rounded off the sharp spots, and used them to cover flame petal shoots. I used to think nothing bad would ever happen to my dad. He was pretty tall for a grounder, nearly 5 feet, and I mostly remember looking up at him when he was talking to me. I wanted to be just like him, even though he told me not to, that there wasn't anything about prospecting that was worth it. I said I understood, but he knew I was lying, and he never made me promise anything different. Then he was gone, and what was I supposed to do but try to live like him? Except the crafting, which I ain't too good at, actually. Folks told me I looked kind of like my dad, except shorter. Same red skin, same red hair and eyes. Truth be told, I'm nothing like him. People liked him. The best I can do is keep my head down and keep out of the way. Maybe I was too tired, or maybe I was too busy living in some damn fool memory, but either way, I must not have been paying attention for a while, because all of a sudden, Rig sets to growling and yelping and nearly scares me into falling off my rock. It might have been better to fall anyway, because when I looks up, what should I see but the last thing I would have expected? 7 feet tall, red horns and tail, spiky fur, teeth that don't fit proper inside the mouth. Yep, sure enough, flame demon, and there he was right in front of us, gnashing his teeth and eyes so wide they could have dropped outside of his head. Maybe he was trying to decide which one of us to eat first, or maybe he was just having fun, but anyways, he didn't move at first, just looked at us with that crooked smile of his. Frankly, I just about gave it up there and spent most of my last cycles alive cursing myself for being so stupid. First of all, you almost never see flame demons this far west, but like I said, I didn't know this territory too well, and things had been kind of strange lately. And if we hadn't been so desperate for a couple of lousy flame petals, we wouldn't have been out so far from home anyways. And I should have been paying closer attention. But now we were in it for sure, and I just felt bad for Rig, mostly. I mean, me, I'm just a washed-up prospector, you know, but he don't know any better, and if it wasn't for me, maybe he'd be running around free somewhere instead of getting eaten alive. And wouldn't you know it, the damn fool Solar stepped in front of me, growling, as if it could do anything against a flame demon. Solars aren't small, you know. I mean, they can defend themselves, but against a flame demon, well, really. Come on now, I says in a low voice, holding my search stick like a fool while the demon steps forward. Come on, you don't want none of Rig here. You let him go and deal with me. I got what you want anyways. And I held up my stick and got ready to do some damn foolish thing like yell in charge or something like that. But just then I thought I heard a sound above us, kind of whistling, and I took a step back. The demon raised his claw and got ready to swipe, but he never did. All of a sudden, something hit him head-on from above, some flurry of white and feathers, and down he goes in a heap while Rig and I jumps back. First, I couldn't tell what happened, but then I see the demon get to his feet, shaking his head and screaming bloody murder, and I saw the other thing get up as well. Even now, I can't explain what it was like to see it stand the first time. Tall, thin, two arms, two legs, curly brown hair, white skin, and young. But this expression on its face, kind of serene, like it knew what was going to happen, that's what amazed me the most. That and the things on its back, of course. Because that demon comes up swinging and screaming, you know, and in it comes, and the other one just smiles, and all of a sudden I saw it unfold, these wings by Saul. Wings, I tell you. White feathered wings, almost as wide as the body was tall, and out it stretches them. The demon hesitated, then roared again and came in, and the other thing, well, it just lifted its arms, you know, and all of a sudden those wings glowed blue, and blue light shot out all over the place, and I fell backwards near blinded. I heard this screech, and then a wail, and then a sigh, and then nothing at all. And when I looked up and I could see again, there it all was, Rig on the ground, whimpering like a baby, some pile of ash that I think used to be a flame demon, and that other creature lying on the ground with his eyes closed, those huge wings folded beneath him. Entrances, I tell you. That kid knew how to make an entrance.
That's it. Very good. Very good.
So, very different, like I said.
Yeah, very much.
Every year at Gen Con, I do a seminar called Spin a Yarn, which is 2 hours of the audience shouting out stupid suggestions, and I have to put them all into a story. The result is usually a long develop because they have 2 hours, and it's usually like a sort of stew you'd never want to eat because things don't go with other things that they shout out, and I have to somehow. So the stories end up being very much overlong and padded as stories just to get them all in, because that's the promise they'll all be in. So I'm going to edit the hell out of this one as I read it, okay? And don't expect it to be polite.
She's focused on Curious
Cool,
George, don't
okay.
Worry.
So these are excerpts from every Rebel a masterpiece. I am not, Rambuck says sourly, wearing green nipples that spit out milk at the audience. I don't care how drunk those nobles are. Someone is going to get angry at being showered with milk and try to put a sword through us. Possibly several swords. Perhaps if we use fire wine instead of milk, eh? One stag blinks. Are you going to pay for fire wine? Otherwise, there goes our take for the evening right there. Lara leans forward to wag a finger, looking none too pleased. It's your turn to wear the buxom false front, Ram, he growls. All the rest have done it. Rest of us have done it, and so far you've managed to get out of wearing the genie spewing codpiece too. Rambuck makes a lewd gesture involving energetic thrustings of his fingers, three plucked nose hairs, and exaggerated kissing mimicry. His four fellow shorter buckles watchers all return it with interest. Lord Massillon airily waved a goblet as large as his head. This revel is going to be a jewel, sweetest. What was old Roaring Horde calling those paintings? Some Omnian word or other. Masterpiece, Lord Dearest, Lady Massillon supplied sweetly from where she sat across the grand chamber at her painting frame, brush poised.
Masterpiece, thank you, lady. Indeed. On my word, sir, on my word, this revel of ours is going to be a positive masterpiece. Cleverest revel players in the city, and they've got all our best ideas to work with. They can hardly fail.
The visiting Lord Raventree allowed, as how they hardly could, all things considered. And if they do, Lady Massillon commented, as sweetly as before, leaning forward to deftly daub a hint of purple to her swiftly taking shape portrait of Lord Raventree being strangled, just where it was most needed, they shall pay the price. My new rack has arrived and needs testing. We'll see how swiftly it can stretch halflings to proper human height. Lord Royal Jardeth flashed the bright grin that had momentarily fooled women all over the city. So, how's the Thayan buy a bride business? Brandy Trades Ward shopkeepers snapping them up yet? Snapping, no, but selling steadily, his friend Lord Largar Husteem replied, leaning back against the elegantly paneled back of the booth with goblet in hand. If they just stop trying to pay me in cows, the lower orders are so uncouth. I have on occasion noticed that, yes. Oral slid into the bright memory's best booth to join his friend, raising a finger to Booth Jack to signal that his throat was in need of, as usual. Both lordlings were the youngest of their families, several brothers distant from ascending to reign over the respective houses, which state of affairs was just fine with them. They possessed ample idle time, even more ample coins, and the youthful good looks that, when coupled with garments that shouted, "I am richer than many golds," made women look twice. Neither had any need to do any sort of work, but schemes such as Larglar's bride setting did much to banish boredom, if nothing else. A maid whose charms were both spectacular and well displayed bent low over the table to present Worrell's customary tall glass, frothing with a concoction fancifully dubbed mind flavor jelly. She paused in her pose to give him time for his customary fondle, whispered throaty thanks for those attentions that she probably did not mean, and retreated. The Bower of Bright Memory Club paid its staff well to humor the behavior of nobles and supplied ample free cosmetics to cover bruises. Rorl sipped deeply of his drink, sighed appreciatively, and asked, "So, what's this scheme of yours? It better be good to make me even think of attending a masculine revel. Gloomy old asses, the lot of them." "Precisely. Moreover, there's a score to be settled. Last time they made us play children's revel games to win anything to eat. Remember?" "Ugh, yes, I had managed to banish that distasteful memory. I wonder what demeaning it is here they have planned for this time. Happy dancing halflings wearing funny costumes and telling jokes the Masselins have written. Gods, are we allowed to throw things at the little runts? Platters, chairs, fat old noble ones seated next to us?" "Of course not. However, that's where my little plan comes in."
"Do tell."
"My Thayan contacts occasionally offer me some interesting things. These, for example." Largar placed a tiny pouch on the table, thumbed it open, and let two sparkling gems spill out. Rorl peered at them, but made no move to touch them. Larglar's sense of humor was sometimes vicious. He raised both eyebrows in a silent question. "In spelled glass, when you break them, the magic is released." "And that magic is?" "A lust spell. Short range, but affecting all human females it can reach, making them hunger only for happiness." Worrell whistled. "I had no idea such a spell existed."
"It's new. Very new."
"Ah, you mean there are still problems with it. Unforeseen sidefire effects, that sort of thing." "That sort of thing, indeed. Are you in?" Their eyes met.
"Of course."
The gems disappeared back into the pouch in a trice, and it was slid into Rorl's waiting hand. "I have two identical gems, and we'll use them. Only woman co-spire affected, remember. Locate your breakings well." Rorl smiled and signaled for another drink.
"But of course."
"Oh, I keep my investments very secure,"
Rumbuck sang heartily, winking broadly at the audience. Resplendent in the prominently breasted false front, a frilling gown that a daring noble lady might have worn 12 seasons earlier, enough face paint to decorate the entire front of a large building, and the cross-crossed coils of a long black cord held by Rambuck on one side of him and Onstag on the other, Nindle tittered shrilly at the audience, batting false eyelashes that might have passed for a strip of black fur.
"Yes,
he keeps his investments very secure.
The other shorter Bushwalkers thundered in chorus. Then Onstag stepped forward, giving the noble audience a leering wink so broad that he nearly fell off the stage doing it, and spun away. Rambach let go of his end of the cord, and Nindle twirled on the points of his pointed noblewoman's boots like a child's spinning bob until free of the cord, whereupon she wobbled perilously, acquired a look of pronounced alarm, and fell into the waiting arms of a drooling, tongue-wagging, furiously winking Onstag. The audience, or at least the male half of it, roared with laughter, slapping their thighs and neighbor's shoulders as they shook and wept with laughter, guffawing like so many braying mules. Lady Massillon winced, bent her head away from the spray of spittle that Lord Massillon's mirth was watering their table with, and crooked one finger slightly. The servant standing behind her, who'd been watching for just that signal, glided smoothly forward and bent over so Lady Massillon could whisper in his ear, "Is the rack oiled and ready?" The servant started to nod, but Lady Massillon never heard his reply, the tinging of small gem-shaped pieces of glass breaking was already dying away, and two young nobles were ducking aside from the sudden rush of noble ladies and their noble daughters, sitting up, gasping loudly, and then springing to their feet and rushing the stage. With a swirl of brown hair, gold combs, and large golden hoop earrings, Lady Massillon joined them. The halflings needed only one look at the well-eyed onslaught. Gowns tearing and gem-drenched highborn women clawing at each other to get past without ever looking anywhere but straight at them. Yes, them, the shorter buckle swashers. With one accord, they spun around and fled across the stage, hurrying for the doors that led into the grand royal chamber. They'd all seen looks of lust before, a time or three, and knew what would happen if those long and gold-dusted talons the noble women were pleased to call fingernails ever reached them. This wasn't just lust. This was a lust rampage. Buckle swashers shed hampering bits of costume without hesitation, sprinting and leaping for their lives. Larm tripped on his costume gown and went down with a despairing eep. He went on rolling hard, hoping to regain his feet before two scent-reeking human bodies crashed into him and luckily also into each other, so the impacts that might have shattered even his sturdy bones were spent on each other. Teeth rattled, not his. Someone bit through their lip and spat blood, and Larm twisted desperately out from under, dragging the heavy weight of two noble women for a long, long breath before the gown tore and he was free. He hoped they found the sight of a stained and patched clout, framed by tatters of torn gown and hairy halfling legs churning along at full speed, a little less alluring than armed and armored guards barred the door, grinning openly. Let the hired entertainment get away when they're bid fair to be a highly amusing spectacle? No fear. Rambuck dived to the floor in front of their boots, sprang up into a chainmail-covered gut, and kicked off it, springing along the wall to land in a dead run with a retching guard in his wake. Onstag veered after him, clutching a tangle of black cord to his chest as if it was a bag of treasure, and the other shorter buckle swashers were right behind. Noble ladies howled hungrily or shrieked from their seats if the magic hadn't touched them, and noble lords roared orders and swung dramatic swords or pounded on the tables in their red-faced mirth. Rambuck ran out of the chamber and sprang aloft again, planting a boot in the face of a doorjack who was reaching for him, landing with a brief thunder on the table, and then, with a crash of blown and tinted glass from lantern that moments earlier had depicted a ship asail on a sun-drenched sea, plunged through the window. Though a killing fall down to the courtyard outside might well be waiting, his fellow buckle swashers did not hesitate as they followed. "Great revel!" they heard one old lord roar to another as the din of the room faded behind them. "Splendid! Simply splendid!" The fall proved to be only a dozen feet or so onto a stone battlement. Rambuck was already most of the way along it in one direction, with spear-waving guards pounding along towards the buckle swashers from the other. They wasted no breath on curses or comments, but sprang up and ran after Rambuck. Spear points can be sharp. It took only a few boot-pounding moments for them to catch up with Rambuck, who was diving between the legs of a lone, bewildered guard and punching the man in the cods as he did so. The man whirled, more baffled than heard, thanks to intimate armor plate, and Rambuck sprang up and punched him neatly in the throat before he could do more than gawk. The man staggered backwards, choking and clutching at his throat, spear falling with bouncing clangs, and Rambuck took one look at, yes, the killing fall from the battlements down into the courtyard, turned to the nearest window, and burst back through it. His fellow buckle swashers followed, breaking back into Massillon Towers rather more noisily than they'd ever broken into any premises before. They found themselves in a room where startled servants had been folding linens on rows of long tables, and were now standing hastily back as Rambuck tore through them, seeking the door at the far end of the room that must lead into a passage. "Stairs down!" Onstag shouted. "Where?" A pompous-looking manservant frowned at him. "Why? Who are you?" "The place is on fire, man!" Onstag bellowed, not slowing the slightest. "Stairs down, man!" "Fire!" A maid shrieked obligingly, and the servants started running in all directions to all sorts of doors. The Buckles watchers did curse, then, as they saw Rambuck wrench open the door, spring out into the passage, and promptly shout an alarm. He raced to the left, and a guard with a Lord Halberd came running from the right, obviously chasing him. Onstag started swearing in earnest. By the time they reached the passage, Rambuck was well down it and toppling a decorative suit of armor with a terrific crash. The guard stumbled, skidded, and then started to pick his way through its litter, waving his halberd wildly. He was right beside a row of gleamingly impassive suits of armor, and Onstag grinned like a wolf and sprang high at the paneled wall behind their collective heads. Nindle and Millar crowed with delight as the whole row started to topple. Their noise was enough to make the guard try to turn to see who they were, and probably get buried in down-crashing armor. Onstag and Rambuck grinned at each other and watched Larm, Nindle, and Millar leap and twist and spring high through all the metal to join them. Without a word, the gun spun around again and started running on down the passage, seeking stairs, preferably stairs that led down. The passage ended at such stairs, and down the thankful buckle swashers went. "Fire!" servants were calling on the floors they were descending past. They paid no heed, but plunged out a door at the bottom that led in the other direction from the bulk of the mansion, and found themselves in the courtyard, a broad terrace of sand-hewed stone surrounded by trees, with ornamental bower turrets at its corners, a stone privy house midway down its stone side railings, a stables at one end, and there they are! The shriek came from right overhead, and was so high and shrill that they barely recognized the voice of their coldly unpleasant lady host. It went even more high and shrill a moment later, when it turned into a scream and grew rapidly louder and nearer, to end almost at their feet with a wet, nasty-sounding splat. Lady Maslin bounced once, and then lay still, dark ribbons of blood flowing out from her with astonishing speed. There was enough left of her face to make it very clear who she was, and that she was dead. Ramstuck and Onstag looked at each other in utter terror. "We're doomed," Onstag managed to say, finding his voice first.
"Start running!"
"Where?" "Chultun beyond. Elf bristling Evermeet, gods take it." "No," Onstag said. "Help me with the body." "What? Stag, are you mad?" "Wellly and incurably, and have been for years.
Help me with a stony body!"
Rambuck blinked, shivered as the other buckle swashers gathered around him, and then bent and took up a pair of noble knees. "Get going!" he barked at the three younger buckle swashers, thrusting with his head in an effort to point.
"That way! Run!"
They gaped, opened their mouths as if to ask questions or argue, and then ran. And we're just about out of time. So I'll leave it there. The whole thing's on the Wizards of the Coast website, hidden under the Mirror Stones thing. Every Revel a Masterpiece, if you want to find out what happens. But, after all, every Revel has to be a masterpiece.
Has to be a masterpiece.
Very cool. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you guys for coming.
Yeah.